Welcome back
to Word on the Hills. I'm going to ask Pat about her dialogue, which many of her readers think is one of her strengths. So tell us how you go about writing convincing dialogue, Pat.
Well, I have read that dramatic dialogue is not like real life conversation. There are no boring bits. The characters never say, "Hello, how are you?" There's no day-to-day chat like that. It has to be dramatic. It has to move. And each character has an agenda, something they want to accomplish in that dialogue, so that this dialogue is pushing for his agenda this way and this other character is pushing for her agenda that way. So there are twists and turns and surprises. And when I'm writing, I always think, how can I twist it? How can I make this character do something surprising? What is this character secretly wanting to say? And then I just let them blurt it out. The dialogue doesn't have to make sense. It doesn't have to be a logical conversation. Each character is trying to push for whatever they want in the drama to happen next. And the other thing is that having a character not say what's on his mind is very powerful. For instance, in my book, Sean is not wanting to talk about the fact that he was driving when his brother was killed. He never wants to mention that. He doesn't want anybody to know about it. And so it's this secret that's hanging over every conversation he has. And he comes close to saying it sometimes, and then he backs away from it. And
does the reader know more than the characters in the novel? That is to say, how soon does the reader become aware that Sean has this deep secret?
I have been told that readers suspect that something is wrong with him. He doesn't behave normally, but they don't know what it is. Mm. They just know that he had a horrible relationship with his father. His father kicked him out of the house. That's very near the beginning. And he has a horrible relationship with this brother that he has all these memories of that keep crowding in. He has nightmares about his brother. Hmm. And so we know that there's something regarding his brother.
Yes. Well, that's interesting.
Thank you.
So what do you think writers' critique groups contribute to a writer's development? You've said that one such group gave you the prompt for the novel.
Yes.
What else do you get out of them?
Well, I don't think I would get any writing done at all without my writers' groups. I need a deadline, and if I have a writers' group once a week, then I write once a week, and I get the writing done, because I would be embarrassed to go to a writers' group with nothing. And also, I really need the honest feedback. I would not be one of these writers that could go to a cabin in the woods and write in secret. I need people to respond to the writing as it's going along and tell me honestly what they think. It's no good if they keep saying, "Oh, that's nice. Oh, that's so good." They have to really give you honest feedback. Otherwise, the writing doesn't improve. And so you have to get a very tough skin.
Yes, we probably all have to develop that.
Yes.
Well, what would you like to read next from Roadblock? Are you going to go on with the story, or are you going to take a later piece?
I thought I would finish that bit in chapter one. Okay, so we're back in the room with the family after Jenny has been killed. This is later the same day. His father had come to school to pick him up. His father had said, "We're going home now, son." In the car, his father stared straight ahead, his big fists wrapped tightly around the steering wheel until he drove into the driveway. Kurt knew that something was so terribly wrong he dared not ask. He was small for his age, but right now he felt smaller than usual. People were arriving at the front door, strangers to him mostly, a few he recognized. His father said, "Before we go in, you should know your sister was killed by a car. That's why everyone is here. I don't know what else to tell you, son." Then he leaned over, grabbed Kurt around the shoulders and hugged him so tight he couldn't breathe. His father hung on like that, choking and shuddering, until he pushed Kurt away. "We'd better go in," he had said as he shoved open the car door. Now the minister, Reverend Kimball, dressed in black with a blazing white collar, knelt beside Kurt. Kurt scrunched himself deeper into the corner of the big chair. "How are you doing, son?" "I'm not your son," Kurt thought. He could feel the minister's eyes trying to pierce into his head. "Your sister had a very short lifetime, like a butterfly." "That's just the way it is. We have to accept it, son. The Lord called her home." "A butterfly? Fuck you," thought Kurt. He stood up and pushed his way through the adults into the kitchen. His mother was seated at the Arborite table, facing a clutter of bowls and platters covered with cookies, muffins, cold meat, and cheese. A lady said, "Have some tea, Marie. It'll calm your nerves, dear." But his mother continued staring into nothingness, her face pinched and swollen, her fist white-knuckled, gripping a tissue. An old man was standing beside his father, saying, "We can't know the ways of the Lord, Dan. When tragedy strikes, it's a mystery." "That's all you can say, a goddamn mystery." The old man lifted his cup to his lips, hands shaking and slop spilling onto his blue plaid shirt. Kurt's father's arms were crossed under his brown beard and his eyes directed at the floor. When he looked up, he noticed Kurt and reached an arm out to him. Kurt felt like a little kid, but he huddled into his father's big chest and smelled the comforting sweat of his jersey. "This is my son. Say hello to Mr. Francis, Kurt." The old man smiled so warmly that Kurt surprised him by answering hello. "I bet you feel like shit," the old guy said. "I know I do. This is a hell of a thing, a hell of a thing." Kurt's father squeezed his shoulder and said, "You got that right, Mr. Francis. I'm sure I don't know what we're going to do." He shook his head. "I know what you're going to do. For the next 3 days, you'll be kept busy. You'll have to go down to the funeral parlor, make arrangements, select a casket, that sort of thing. Then the cemetery office, choose a plot for the burial. Somebody has to write the obituary for the paper. I can help you if you need me to." "Appreciate that, Mr. Francis. Do you want the minister to give the eulogy or somebody else?" "The minister. He's the only one who'd know what to say." "You won't have a minute's peace till after the funeral, and that's probably a good thing. Let it all sink in." The old man scratched his jaw with a bony finger. "Then you best go straight back to work, back to your routine. It's Marie we should worry about. She's got no job. Not good for her to be alone." "I don't know how I can leave her to go back to work. She'll never get over this." "I'll have a word with some of the women. Ask them to drop by for tea, take her for a walk, so she won't be alone." "So kind. Thank you, Mr. Francis." "And now, what about this young lad here? What are we going to do with you, eh, Kurt? You're about the right age for riding, I'd say. I got a couple of horses need exercise. You grab a friend and come out to the farm. You can start riding when you're ready." Kurt looked up at his father, who nodded. He felt confused, sick to his stomach and weak, too weak to ride a horse. Why was everything happening so fast? He wanted everyone to stop talking and leave the house. He wanted to be alone with his mother and father. He wanted answers. Kurt could stand no more. He ran out the side door, grabbed his bike, and pedaled away as fast as he could. He followed a familiar route to the edge of town, where the nature reserve stretched over 100 acres of woods, with a stream meandering through the middle and pathways on either side. He pushed his feet hard against the pedals, around and over, around and over. Gravel flew from under the wheels in angry spurts as he climbed the hill. Breath came fast and hot into his lungs. Before he burst, he reached the gnarled maple tree where he and Jonathan had carved their initials 2 years ago and then cut their thumbs to mingle their blood in a bond of brotherhood. He threw down the bike at the base of the tree and, reaching up, swung his leg over the lower limb and climbed until he was surrounded by a canopy of leaves. Then he burst into sobs, breath-wrenching, stomach-heaving, lonely cries. He leaned into the tree and choked on his anguish.
Well, thanks for coming, Pat, and thanks for reading
the
first part of your book. And thank you to our listeners for tuning in today. We hope you'll join us next week at this time to meet another writer in the region. Our guests in coming weeks bring a great diversity of interesting lives and works with them, and we are looking forward to interviewing them too. And if you're listening and you're an author and would like to be interviewed, or know someone who would like to participate in the program, please write to us at thebirdonthehills@gmail.com. And if you would like to read some of the authors who will be interviewed on this program in the coming weeks, including Pat, buy or borrow a copy from the library of our 2012 anthology, Hill Spirits. It's available at Avid Reader in Coburg, Lighthouse Books in Brighton, at local libraries and online. And to find out more about Spirit of the Hills, Northumberland Hills Arts Association, please investigate our website, www.spiritofthehills.org. Thanks again for joining us. We hope you'll join us next week as well.